Party people, welcome to the Hiking My Feelings virtual campfire. I am Sydney Williams. I'm your host of this glorious gathering that we do every week here on Thursdays, 3 p.m. We are live today from Bankers Hill, San Diego proper. I needed a little bit of good Wi-Fi because I've got some extra super legends on the show today and I didn't want to drop the call. So I'm really stoked. We've got a lot of stuff going on. Before we get into our guests, I wanted to share some updates for the Hiking My Feelings, Take a Hike Diabetes campaign. I'm going to lose it. Okay. So we released some extra facilitators this week. So we have Kenya Jackson Salters from Outdoor Journal Tour. She and I are going to be offering a community call, the day after the election during the Take a Hike Diabetes campaign, because no matter who you vote for or where you stand on the political side of the fence, it's wild out there right now, y'all. Like, we need to band together and find a place where we can feel safe and cry or celebrate, whichever one you need to do come the day after the election. So we've got Kenya joining us. She's going to be leading a meditation to help us feel grounded when the world feels like it's burning down around us. I'm really looking forward to that. We also have Melanie Wassman coming back. Melanie is, I would say, the better half of Rebel and Muse. Her and Kaleo run a really awesome retreat organization. They do all kinds of great yoga classes and wellness content. And so Melanie is going to be joining us for a tincture making workshop. So we are in the process of securing all of our ingredients. And then for the first however many people that sign up, we'll send you a kit and then we'll do it all together on Zoom and learn about botanicals and herbs and plant medicine and that kind of stuff. So we'll be making our own tinctures. And I haven't put these on the website yet, but I'm going to tell you anyway, because I can't wait anymore. I'm going to drum roll it. So last year, actually, I should check my calendar because it might've been like exactly a year ago. I was hiking with one of our community members, Amanda Dulong, and we were in Fort Worth, Texas. And she was like, oh my gosh, you know who you should follow who really loves healing in nature is Melissa Urban. And I was like, who's Melissa Urban? She's like, oh, she's this awesome chick. She's from Salt Lake City. She's the CEO of Whole30. And she like connects with nature all the time. And she talks about it all the time on her Instagram. And so I started following Melissa from like the healing in nature perspective. And then was like, oh, also Whole30 is pretty important and awesome. So the registered dietitian, Stephanie, and Melissa herself will be joining us for the virtual campfire on November 12th. I'm going to lose it because they're both really cool. And that means we've got now three registered dietitians. The next one I'll be announcing next week because that's super secret still. But we've got Julianne Mahoney, the outdoor RD. She's going to talk to us about intuitive eating. Mila Clark Buckley is not a registered dietitian, but she's going to be sharing diabetic friendly recipes. We're going to be busting like diet culture myths. We're going to be breaking down stigmas around diabetes and just teaching everyone how to like navigate this world without shame or guilt or anything. We also have Zion I, who is one of my favorite humans on this planet. We had an awesome conversation on the virtual campfire back in June about everything that was going on with the social uprising and racial justice in America and how we have a unique opportunity, especially now in this new COVID world where all the things that used to work don't exist really anymore. And we're finding this new path through life. And we're going to channel that conversation into talking about diabetes as well. Because when you're first diagnosed, you're like, what? At least I was, and maybe other people didn't experience this, but I think they did. I was just like, I don't know what foods I can eat. Is this going to make my body explode? Like, what's happening? So we're going to talk about mindfulness. Also, when it comes to diabetes management, stress reduction is a super important part of it. And one of the things that has been instrumental, funny joke, in my healing journey is listening to empowering music. And so Zion, one of his big initiatives within his community is talking about how lyrics matter. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about mindfulness as it pertains to like the world around you. And then we've just got like all kinds of epic people. We got Chris Maynard from Glucose Revival. We've got a couple other type 1 diabetes folks that we're going to be introducing next week. I'm like on this mission, and Chris is my partner in this, to unite the diabetes community. Cause from what I've heard, and I haven't witnessed this a lot firsthand, but apparently there's like some infighting between type 1 and type 2 and like who has it worse. It's all terrible. Like none of this is fun. Chronic illness sucks no matter which one it is. And we can make such a big difference if we band together as like a community of 100 million plus people with type 1, type 2, and prediabetes. So we'll be talking about that. I am just really excited. So we've got some awesome prizes too. And so I wanted to share a little bit about that as well as we're talking about Take a Hike Diabetes. One of the cool things that we started doing is opening up the teams. So if you're watching this and you're like, oh, I want to track my miles, I want to help contribute towards Sydney's audacious and ridiculous goal of hiking 1 million miles for diabetes awareness. How do I do that? Start a team, encourage your friends, family, and colleagues to join it. And then you can be like, yeah, our team is so dope. We raised X amount of dollars. We hiked so many miles and we're like 30 million people strong or whatever. That would be cool. Cause then if we did 30 million people, we'd be getting to that 1 million mile goal real quick. You could all walk like a quarter mile and be done. So join a team. We've got some on the website for the Kilter Rewards thing. We'll put those in the show notes at the end. If you want to join one, email me or send me a comment here on YouTube. If you're watching on YouTube, send us a DM on Instagram and we can get a team started for you. And then you can start recruiting your friends. As far as prizes go, our friends at Hike It Off magazine who have started a team. So if you want a team to join, definitely hit up Jamie and join their team. But they've donated their 5 registrations to their new program. So Jamie was in our Blaze Your Own Trail to Self-Love summer session earlier this year. And she once she got through with that, she created this amazing program called I Am the Wild. It's a 30-day experience. You get journal prompts every day, mindfulness tips, reconnect with nature. It's like all the kinds of stuff that we love here. So she's donating 5 registrations to that experience. And then also like a Hike It Off prize pack, which is like a hat and a t-shirt. And you guys know that we love our friend K-Bong. He is the keyboardist for Stick Figure, the frontman of his own music career and band. And he's donating a K-Bong merch pack as well as a cameo, which if you're not familiar with that, a lot of musicians have been doing it lately. It's a personalized greeting. You can use it for yourself. You can use it for a friend or a family member. But like, if you're like, all I want is a shout out from K-Bong, we got you, boo. Like just come participate in this challenge and it can be yours and it's going to be awesome. So those are some of the cool prizes. We've got some great conversations coming up with other brands that are chipping in some prizes. So we'll talk about those more next week. We're going to do another announcement of facilitators next week on the virtual campfire, but wanted to share the excitement with you guys for this. Can I see your hat real quick? This is not the hat that we're doing, but I want to show you because like we kind of switched it up. So the hat for, if you raise $100 or donate $100, you get to Take a Hike Diabetes Care Package, which is our candle, one of our sassy stickers, a version of this hat. So it's not this hat specifically, but I wanted to show it off because our old hats just had the logo in the middle. Now we're like, hey, it's in your face. Front glows in the dark. So you can go on a night hike and not get lost. You can be like, oh, there they are. There's our friends with their logos on their faces. And now we have the Take a Hike Diabetes hashtag on the side. So this is Barry's fancy hat. The other one is a camo and khaki trucker style hat. So it like breathes, you don't get your sweaty head while you're hiking. So that's a really cool prize pack too. And then if you go to the Kilter Rewards website for our event, you can see the full prize list as it stands right now. And we're still rolling out prizes as we get confirmations from sponsors and vendors and partners. So if you're watching this and you represent an outdoor brand and you're like, hey, I'd like to get down with the diabetes community, hit me up. Like, let's do some stuff. Let's give away some cool prizes. So one of the cool things about the Take a Hike Diabetes campaign is next year we are planning on being on the road again. As much as I love being in one place and the Reggae Ranch is a beautiful place to call home, I desperately want to go hike with you guys. I didn't realize how much I missed this. So we've picked a handful of different markets around the United States where urban adventures are possible and or there's a high prevalence of diabetes. So this kind of leads me into our next guest, since urban adventures are one of the things that we're trying to showcase. Like a thing that we're really passionate about here at Hiking My Feelings is like making the outdoors accessible to everybody, not just people who can afford to go to a state park or a national park or take like big long chunks of time off to go hike these big trails. You can have these adventures in your own backyard. And so the Chicago Outer Belt is a really good example of that. It's a 220-mile trail that goes around the city of Chicago, and most of that's accessible by public transportation. So without further ado, I'm going to talk to you about our first guest. So Liz Thomas is just a legend. Like, I was reading this bio and I was like, I can't keep tagging all these iconic industries and newspapers that she's worked with. So Liz is a professional hiker, speaker, and writer who held the women's self-supported speed record, which means she was the fastest known person on the Appalachian Trail from 2011 to 2015. Like, I just want to sink that in for a second. That is 2,181 miles from Georgia to Maine, and she held the record for unsupported female, which means that she did it by herself and she didn't have some team following her and like injecting food into her body. She just like went and did it by herself. Also, Outside Magazine calls her a through hiking legend and the queen of urban hiking. I would agree with that because she's hiked 20 plus long distance trails, including the Triple Crown of Hiking. So that's the Pacific Crest Trail, the Appalachian Trail, and the Continental Divide Trail. You met Zelson a couple of weeks ago. She was also a Triple Crown hiker. You met Akuna on our first campfire ever. He's a Triple Crown hiker. I'm just surrounding myself with these people that do this because I also have a goal of being a Triple Crown hiker. I want to see if this body can handle that. So she's also a former outdoor staff writer for the New York Times and Wirecutter, and the current editor-in-chief for the outdoor web magazine Treeline Review. She's also the author of Long Trails, Mastering the Art of the Thru Hike, which received the 2017 National Outdoor Book Award for Best Instructional Book. And the judges said, and I quote, "This is destined to become the Bible of the sport." I don't know like how else you can epically introduce somebody, but Liz, pop on your camera, come on down, The Price is Right. Now we're dancing, we're waiting for Liz, we're so excited. Hey! Yes. So good. Oh my gosh. Thanks. I'm so excited to chat with you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Sydney.
Oh my Lord. So tell us where you are and like, where are you physically right now and where are you from originally?
I'm in Southern California, but I'm originally from Northern California.
Awesome. Whereabouts in Northern California?
I grew up in Sacramento.
Oh, cool. Sweet. That's a hot place some parts of the year.
Yes, yes, it is. Got me really used to hiking in the desert. I'm like, oh, it's only 105.
So have you always been outdoorsy or is this something that you came into like later in life?
That's a good question. I would not have said that I grew up as an outdoorsy kid, but I had a first grade teacher who was really, really into having us spend time in nature. And I loved this little nature trail that she took us to on a field trip so much that I kept on saying like, hey, mom and dad, can we go back there? Can we go there on the weekends? I had my third grade birthday party there, which I invited everyone in the class and I gave everyone an invitation. I was like, hey, let's go on a hike. That's what I want to do for my birthday, which I'm sure my parents were thrilled because it was a lot cheaper than the bowling alley that my sister had her birthday party at. The only catch was like, I was like, I really want to see the wildlife. So we all met at the trailhead at 5:30 in the morning. And some kids
actually
came. That is
a raging third grade birthday party.
Yeah, it was really fun. You know, looking back in retrospect, I'm like, oh, that is so telling for who I became doing that as an 8-year-old.
That's amazing. So tell us a little bit about how you got into long distance hiking, because you have done like every trail that I've ever known of. So tell us a little bit about your journey to start doing long distance hikes.
Yeah. So, you know, like I did this like 1 mile nature trail a lot when I was a kid. And then, you know, my parents were not outdoorsy people at all. I always were like, hey, let's go camping. They're like, we have no idea what that is. So I didn't really get into the outdoors until I was in college and I got involved in some college outdoor groups. And that's really where I like learned some basic skills, took like a wilderness first aid class, got more and more into hiking and some rock climbing. And that was really where I first started learning about the Pacific Crest Trail. I'm like, oh, this goes from Mexico to Canada. And like, the more I learned about it, I just like remember sitting in my dorm room being like, all right, I'm not doing my homework. All I want to do is read people's trail stories.
That's so cool. So was the Pacific Crest Trail your first long distance trail?
So I actually did the Tahoe Rim Trail, which is about 165 miles long. Yeah, you know the Tahoe Rim Trail.
That's on my list. And Taylor and Thor are from Tahoe, so I'm like, let's go knock this out real quick.
It's so beautiful, and it was such like a great like step to make sure that this was, because you know I'd been dreaming and dreaming for years of doing the PCT, and I was like, wait, let's start to see if I like this thing. Like, how am I going to be hiking by myself for this distance? And, you know, like all sorts of things went wrong. My stove didn't work. I was really worried about bears the whole time. My feet really hurt, but I was like, I love this and I want to do more.
That's so cool. So what was your progression from Tahoe Rim? Like what were the trails that you did after that? And then was there a moment in time where you were like, okay, yeah, I just want to do this like all the time? Cause you're a professional hiker. So like, what does that mean and how did you get there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I actually ended up hiking the Appalachian Trail first just because it's easier to start it a little bit earlier in the season because it starts in Georgia and you hit the snowy mountains in Southern California pretty quick if you're hiking the PCT like in March. So I hiked the AT, the PCT, then the CDT, and then I set the AT speed record. You know, like being a professional hiker is kind of a weird thing because like it's really kind of like a hustle surrounding being a hiker. You know, a lot of it's writing, a lot of it's speaking gigs. Some of it was sponsorship back when I was doing that. So yeah, there's like a couple different pieces. It's fun.
So if I heard you correctly, then did you hike the AT twice and you hiked it the second time to set the speed record?
That's right. Yeah.
And what was this? What was your record for that?
My record was 80 and a half days, which beat the previous record, which had been on the books for about almost 20 years by a kind of famous hiking legend who had hiked it with her husband. So I beat her record by a week, which was really cool.
Wow, that's nuts. So for folks that aren't familiar with like fastest known times and how you go about setting one of those, what's the difference between supported and unsupported?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So supported people will often have like a whole crew, a team that will follow them in a van and meet them at every road crossing and be like, all right, here's some food. I'm going to massage your feet. And their packs are a lot smaller. So they like don't have to like walk to the grocery store when they get close to civilization, be like, what am I going to eat? They often don't have to set up tents at all. They just kind of like get to a road and pass out in a van. And instead I'm like, you know, like I'm setting up stuff in the rain, like trying to figure out where's a good spot, being like, oh no, this is too muddy. I got to move. So there's a lot more of these like super small and kind of, you know, like annoying decisions that are involved.
Yeah. And I can imagine that would, there's nothing easy about setting a speed record for sure, but it's a whole different ball game when you're not supported. I think that's abundantly clear. So you used to be a staff writer for the New York Times and Wirecutter. Where was that on your journey through this like hiking that you were doing?
Yeah. So this is kind of a funny way to have come about it, but I got this cold email on my blog about, hey, we came up with this route that's an urban through hike in LA. Would you be interested in doing it? And they had reached out to some other like big name hikers and everyone been like, that's crazy. Why would you want to walk in a city for 200 and something miles? And I was like, living in Colorado at the time, I was like, yeah, that sounds like warm and snow free. I'll do that. I don't have to wait on 70 in traffic. It was really fun. It was a very life-changing experience. So fast forward, one of the people who was really involved in that LA urban hiking community happened to be an editor at Wirecutter and was like, hey, we're doing an outdoor gear section. Would you be interested in coming on staff? And so that's how I got involved with them.
Wow, that's really cool. And so the LA urban adventure, I had read an article about that, but for the folks that are, I have a feeling that the people that are watching have not a lot of understanding around urban adventures like that. So could you talk to us about how you prepped for that? What was the trail like? Well, it's not, what was the trail? What was the route like? And what kind of considerations did you have to take for the LA trip versus your backcountry adventures?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, you know, the LA trip was my first urban hike and it was definitely kind of like, even now I'm like, oh, that is the hardest urban through hike I've ever done. So the mileage and the elevation gain was supposed to approximate something kind of like the John Muir Trail. So a little bit more than 200 miles, you know, I'm not sure it was 45,000 feet of elevation gain, but it's a little bit harder to measure in the city, but it's pretty comparable, like, you know, 5,000 feet of elevation gain days. And I spent a long, long time mapping. So the goal of that urban hike was to connect all of the public stairways in the city. I didn't realize this at the time, but LA is very similar to like San Francisco or a lot of these like iconic cities that have these beautiful stairs and hills, Seattle. And I was like, LA has hills? And it totally does. One of the things is they really wanted me to do it like as fast as I could to see like if it was possible. And kind of they like this idea of attracting other athletes to this, this route, this urban hiking idea. I was hiking from like 5 in the morning until sometimes 11 at night in LA. So this one was, one of the things that I didn't really account for is the difference between walking on dirt, which is so soft, and walking on asphalt and cement in the city. So that's something that I've learned over the years is like, you know, take care of your feet. It's a totally different surface.
Yeah. So were you camping on that route or were you like popping in and out of hotels or like what's the situation for the sleeping on that trail?
Yeah. On that particular route, I was really lucky because the urban hiking community in LA is really closely knit. And so people knew I was coming and they were like, hey, when she comes into my neighborhood, I'd be happy to have her stay at my house. So that's, you know, it's kind of like the shelters, but it's a sort of thing where it's like, if you don't make your 37 miles for the day, you're not going to get to sleep at this person's house. So you have to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. So what other were your other urban hikes as a result of the job and like having stuff to write about, or how did you go about planning some of these other adventures?
Yeah, a lot of them were, just cause I wanted to, once I did the LA hike, I was like, there's really something to this. I saw so much. I met so many people. This was such an amazing way to see a city and to really like feel like you understood the people who live there and how everything's connected in the neighborhoods a lot more than, sightseeing or even like kind of, you know, like having a car in a city. So I hiked San Francisco next, which San Francisco, I think, is considered like the third most public stairwayed city, something like that. I was all about the stairs for a while. So I was like doing San Francisco, Seattle's like one of the most stairwayed cities in the country. So I was like, oh, I need to go there. And by the time I got to Portland, I was like, oh, there's some really, really cool stairs in Portland, but there's also like a lot of Portland that isn't hilly. And I was like, you know, it'd be really cool if I could like crowdsource what people who actually live here, I have a lot of friends in Portland, like what they actually think is really neat, and making sure that I saw all 5 quadrants, which is right. There are 5 quadrants in Portland. And that kind of like changed a lot of the way I thought about urban hiking to highlight other features other than just, like what would make a great workout.
Man, that is incredible. So my friend Serena said that you hiked the loop in Tucson with her. So tell me a little bit about that one. Cause now I didn't know that Tucson had a trail. Actually, like, tell us about that one. And then just like, give us a list of the cities that you've hiked in. Cause I'm just blown away by how many adventures that you've had in cities and then I want to talk about like accessibility to trails and how we can like make this more known so people can go have these adventures.
Yeah. So the way that Serena invited me to Tucson, she's really, really in touch with Visit Tucson, Visit Arizona, tourism department was like, hey, you know, Tucson is about to have completed the largest multi-use trail system in the country, I want to say. I was like, oh, that's really awesome. And I was traveling a lot of the time. She's like, it'd be really awesome if you're here. And I was like, you know, this would be such a cool way to see Tucson, which I've never been to. And I love hanging out with Serena. And it was really, really amazing. The art and the food and the people we met along the way. And they've just felt such an incredible resource. And being able to connect all of these very different areas all in one trail system just blew my mind. It was such a cool hike.
That's really cool.
One of the things that I love about Tucson, so like I go around the country like giving talks to like urban planners and like urban trail designers, and I was like, you know, you wouldn't think of it, Tucson is actually like top of the game, because one of the things that really is a struggle on urban hikes is finding restrooms. And Tucson, it was like clockwork. It was like every trailhead had a restroom and lots of water and shade, because you know, it's Arizona and like water and shade are really important. So I love that about the Tucson route.
That's incredible. And so on these other, what other cities have you been through? Like, rattle some off. This is amazing.
Yeah. It's not my route, but I hiked the Selma to Montgomery National Historic Trail. And that was another one where I really like started thinking about the politicization of walking and how walking can tell a story and can be used as a sign of protest and make a statement. So that was one of my early hikes. I used to live in Denver, so I've done three different ones in Denver, including a brew through.
I love that.
I hiked Chicago. I also did a brew through in Bend.
So you've done the Chicago Outer Belt or did you create a route there?
I created a route there. And actually, when you sent me the email about the Outer Belt, I was like, whoa, this is like the route I did was about 60 miles. And I was like, a 200 mile route. This looks really awesome. And it looks a little more wooded. Like mine was like definitely straight city. The idea with that was to follow the water as much as possible, to follow the rivers as I go to the lake, which was really cool. And especially my sister lives in Chicago. So it was fun to like take her to a neighborhood she'd never been to before. And for me, you know, like I hadn't spent that much time in Chicago. So it's just such an amazing way to see in a city in a way that tourists usually don't get to see it.
Absolutely. So at any point along the way, did you have any consideration, like any concerns for your safety or take any precautions as far as that? Cause you're going through just different environments that you haven't been through before. So what was your planning like around that? And if you had to take extra precautions, what were those like?
Yeah. So, you know, I always tell people that urban hikes are more dangerous than wilderness hikes. And it's because cars are more dangerous than grizzlies.
Agreed.
So I often will wear, depending on the trail, on the route that I make, I'll often wear like a bright yellow reflective safety vest. And sometimes I'll have like lights on my pack or on my hat, kind of like a cyclist would. As far as like people and going through different neighborhoods, I think in general, it's like better to try to keep my hikes within daylight. And if I am going to be out past, like usually, like if I am going to be out later, I'd like to go with a group. Sometimes it's, you know, one of the great things about urban hiking is it's so much easier to be like, hey, do you want to join for me for a couple hours after work on this urban hike in the city that you live in? As opposed to being like, hey, do you want to join me on this mountain hike 5 hours away from where you live?
Right. And in the middle of nowhere. Yeah.
In the middle of nowhere where you need all this gear. So that's one of the things I love about urban hiking is getting to reconnect with people and like get them to come walk and talk with me for a while.
Yeah. And I'm still like, this was like one of the first things you said about the LA trip was that it was similar in mileage and gain to the John Muir Trail. And I like, that's just been rattling around in my brain as you've been saying this. Cause like, I was thinking about our Chicago hike and I was like, it's Chicago. Like there's no mountains there. Like it's probably going to be okay. But I would have thought the same about LA, and that's apparently just not at all true. Like you can get some serious gain on these different kinds of urban adventures.
Yeah. And, you know, that's one of the powers of these urban hikes is like, you don't need any special mapping software. You just go on Google Maps or like, I know people who will just do urban hikes being like, I'm going to go for a stroll with my phone. And when I get to an intersection, I'll be like, oh, that way looks prettier. And then just like, you know, at the end of the day, have like 20 miles or something from doing it that way. Or
cool.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different ways to do urban hiking. And I think it's like, the main goal is to really take that spirit of exploration and being open to new things and meeting new people, just like you would in the backcountry, but you can do that in the city.
That's really neat. So from an accessibility perspective, you mentioned that you've been talking to like urban planners and park or trail builders and stuff like that. What's the pulse of that side of the industry? Like, what are people looking for? What are they trying to build? And what kind of questions are they asking you?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it probably depends on where they are and what they want to build. So the sort of people who are trying to build like communities that are really walking oriented are different than people who are being like, we're going to build a really long trail system around the city. You know, one of the things that I try to focus people on is this idea of the bathrooms. And these sort of things where like, if you're on a bike, like maybe it's a little bit easier to be like, all right, I'm going to go a mile out of my way to go use like a Starbucks restroom or something. But when you're on foot, you're like, this is the longest mile of my life. And in the case of San Francisco was actually the worst for me, which surprised me because I was in this like beautiful hilly residential neighborhood. And I really, really had to go to the bathroom. And I was looking at my phone. I was like, the closest like business like where that might have a restroom is a mile away. So I had to like go all the way down the hill, go to the restroom, go a mile back, had to reclimb the hill. And I was like, this is the worst. And it ended up throwing off my schedule for like the rest of the hike for like 6 more days.
Oh, wow. Man. Okay. So switching this a little bit, how would you define an urban hike?
Yeah. You know, that's a really interesting question. I did a hike in San Diego that goes from the Salton Sea to Torrey Pines, and it goes through a lot of kind of like North County mission trails, that sort of thing. And, you know, like when I originally was looking at it, I was like, oh, is this an urban hike? And I was like, I you know, it goes through a lot of suburban trail systems, but, you know, like I think there's no clear line.
Yeah.
And, you know, in many ways, like, I think the urban hiking has really made me question, like, what is a hike at all? How is a hike different than going for a walk around your block? And, you know, I think a lot of, like, the exploration, doing something new, being open to new experiences, being open to meeting new people, those are the things that make something a hike.
I love that, because one of the things that we've been getting a lot of questions about for our Take a Hike Diabetes campaign is, like, I don't hike. I can go for a walk. And I was like, hiking is basically walking. It just depends on where you're walking and like what kind of terrain you're on. So I love looking at the difference between a walk and a hike is like the exploration of it versus this like very rigid, like if you're not on dirt or pine needles or going up a mountain, then it's not hiking. And it's like, that's not true. Like if you go out and you do 20 miles of anything, I would argue that's a hike, that, or I mean, or a really long walk, but I don't think that it has to be so rigid and like hikes only happen in the wilderness. I love that definition that you provided. So thank you. So let's talk about Treeline Review. That's your new adventure. Well, new-ish, I suppose. How did that get started and what is it? Like, why should people come check it out?
Yeah, so we are an outdoor gear review site that is focused on representation, diversity, inclusivity. And it was formed because I've been working in the outdoor industry doing gear reviews, writing about gear, writing about outdoor experiences for almost a decade, and realized that like I'm the only person of color often who's writing these stories, especially like when it comes to gear, because for some reason like gear was like a very special thing where they weren't, I don't know. But I was like, you know, I really, really know there's so many talented people who know a lot about gear, have a lot of miles, have a lot of experience, who have stories to tell and really want to think critically and objectively about gear. So that's how Treeline Review was formed.
That's incredible. And so what kind of reviews are you doing? Are you doing trails and gear or just like all kinds of experiences?
Yeah. So we do, you know, it started obviously with backpacking and hiking, which was what I wanted to write about. But we actually have a team now of people who are covering water sports and snow sports and cycling and bike packing. And the idea really was to give people the information, not just like, here's the best gear, but like, how do I get into this? How do I find community? We had this really talented writer, Grace Anderson, who was talking about climbing harnesses, but really in the context of like, how do you get into climbing? How do you find people who are like you? How do you feel comfortable climbing? So I think that's such an important piece of the conversation that often gets left out of gear talk.
Yeah, because I feel like gear stuff, it's like, it's the guys that look outdoorsy, who do epic things like free solo a mountain. And it's like, that's cool. Like, I love you. Yay for human tricks. And also you don't just start like free soloing El Cap. Like how do you put on a harness? Like, that's a great question. So what is your vision for Treeline Review and like, where are you at right now? And where do you see this going over the next, however long, 5 years, say?
Yeah. So we're 2 years in and, you know, we're growing and growing phenomenally as people are like, hey, you know, I really want this sort of like totally nerdy, obsessive gear reviews, but really told in a very approachable way that makes me feel comfortable. And I think as more people get into the outdoors, especially like during COVID, we've seen people have just really, really grasped to this idea of like, hey, how do I get into something and feel comfortable while also like making sure that I spend my money in the right place for gear that's going to last.
That's huge. So you wrote a book that is apparently the Bible of long distance hiking, called Long Trails, Mastering the Art of the Through Hike. So I know this has been a very important project to you and for a whole multitude of reasons. I believe you said you were the first woman of color or person of color or woman of color to to write a book about through hiking.
Yeah, I think person of color, as far as I know.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the book, what it's about, what readers can take, like, who is this book for? And then, like, what was that project like? And why is it so important to you?
Yeah, so the book is called Long Trails, Mastering the Art of the Thru Hike. Normally I have it here and I don't know why I didn't like bring it out. It's just like in the next room. But the idea was really to talk about how you go from having the dream of a long distance hike and turn it into reality. And there were a few other books out there on how to long distance hike that were written by white men who are super, super accomplished and very well respected. But I felt like they weren't necessarily beating people where they were, which is like, oh my gosh, I just found out about the PCT and this is amazing and I want to do it. And what do I need? And who do I need to tell? And I'm putting on my food. Like, I'm putting 2,000 miles worth of food in my backpack right now. Oh, wait, this doesn't work. So really the idea was like to break it down, being like, hey, you just have a great idea. What do you need to know? So everything from a lot of the things that like, I've never seen a book talk about, like, how do I tell my family? Like, how do I quit my job? How do I get enough money? How do I let my family know that I'm going to be safe out there? What do I do with my plants and my pet and my kids and my family and my spouse and all of these questions? So I really wanted to show there's like a very diverse community of people who are outdoors, long distance backpacking. And one of the things that I really wanted to stress is like, this is not about the amazing achievements of Liz Thomas and the Liz Thomas way. So I pushed my publisher and it was like, hey, I'd really love to get the voices and stories of all sorts of different hikers of different ages and backgrounds. And, you know, like maybe they could fight about it a little bit. Like we have one guy who's like, I always go stoveless, and someone being like, no, going stoveless is a bad idea. So, you know, just kind of like, you know, like even if someone doesn't glom onto my story, I really want them to see. So like one of the writers is a gentleman in his 60s and be like, you know, that I really love reading his stories because I identify. And that was the goal.
That's so cool. I love the community aspect of that and just representing different viewpoints. And also all those questions that like everybody, like those are the things you need to consider before you buy gear, before you start planning, is like, how do you even get ready for this? And how do you tell these people? I'm going to pick that up like immediately. I need to read that ASAP. So is there anything else that you're working on that you kind of want to like plug or share about or anything that's exciting in your world right now?
Yeah. You know, I definitely think this is true probably for a lot of people is, you know, COVID's put a little bit of a damper on like some of the trips that I had planned. I just completed, putting together a route in San Antonio, Texas for Bike Texas, which is a nonprofit that pushes for trails and active transportation in Texas. And, you know, one of the things that was really neat about that is that Texas has one of the highest traffic fatality rates in the country. So being able to work with them to, you know, be like, how do we put together a beautiful story of a long distance trail of exploring within your city with safety concerns? And that was something that was really, really powerful. And I hope that people are able to go out in this time and explore more within their cities, because I think ultimately the more time we spend, like even walking our own neighborhoods, the more familiar we become with like ourselves and our bodies, but also like how our towns and cities and communities are built. And, you know, like how great it would be to walk to a grocery store within a mile. Like you don't have to train only at the gym or in the mountains. You can train at home.
That's so cool. And for anybody that's watching that is like, okay, yeah, clearly I need to get on this train. Any advice for somebody that's getting started on this journey?
Yeah.
I mean, pick up the book, read it. And also,
yeah. Yeah, the book has a lot of great advice for people being like, all right, so you've heard about long distance trail, you want to do it. What now? But yeah, I would say, you know, just moving is so important. You don't, as I said, you don't have to like climb a mountain all the time in order to train, like just walking to pick up your mail or walking to go to the grocery store or the post office is so important to getting your body used to like, hey, what's it going to be like to be walking for 20 miles a day with a backpack on? I think that's one of the most powerful things you can do for your body is just get out and moving it.
So, so cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us. If you're free to stick around, we'd love to have you stick around for our group gratitude circle, but it's just been so inspiring to talk to you. Does anybody have any questions from Zoom here? If you do, pop on your camera and we'll see what Liz has to say. And if you don't, then we'll keep trucking. Da da da. There we go. Hey, Mary.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. So I heard you mention San Diego. I'm in San Diego. Do you have any salt and sea to Torrey Pines? Sounds incredible. I don't know that I'm ready for that, but I am headed to Torrey Pines in about an hour here. However, do you have other recommendations? I know that like the bridges and stuff around San Diego are popular, but any like San Diego secrets that you might be able to share, or San Diego area secrets for urban hiking?
Ooh.
And then yeah. Everything that you say, Mary, let's go do it.
Yes. Yeah. So hiking versus urban hiking. That's a really interesting question. And San Diego is such a fun place to walk around just in general. So, you know, like I think I'll have to think about that. I wrote a waterfalls guidebook, and obviously San Diego has some really, really neat waterfalls that are really well visited. But there's a few that are kind of like under the radar. So I would advise some of those hikes that are a little under the radar as far as waterfalls go, for the hikes. And then for the urban hikes, you know, like one of the things about the urban hikes is that I love is that you can sit down in Google Maps and be like, okay, I want to visit this place and this place and this place, and then figure out how to connect them. And you can use Google Maps like walking feature to like, they'll find the safest and best route. So, you know, like most of my long distance urban hikes are like put together myself based on where I want to see and where I want to go, which, you know, sometimes is ice cream stores. So, you know, whatever it is that like is your passion or that you love seeing and doing and visiting, I would suggest creating that route yourself.
I love that so much.
Thank you.
Mary, what do you want to go see? Let's make up a route.
Ice cream sounds
good.
Yeah,
I know. I'm like, let's do an ice cream tour of San Diego. We're hiking. The calories don't exist. It's going to be fine.
Perfect.
Thank awesome. You.
And is that cool. Waterfall guide? Is that something online or is that a printed guide that you made?
It's a printed guide. So it's called Hiking Waterfall Southern California through Falcon Guides.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And I put that in the comments too, so you can copy paste in Google search. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Liz. Stick around if you can. And actually, don't pop off your camera just yet. So our next guests are Thor and Taylor, and they are from Do Good Shit. I love this. So I was connected with Taylor and Thor through our mutual friend, Emily, who is the editor of Range Magazine, who met Thor and Taylor, I believe, when they were down in Barrio Loche doing their first project. So they are a pair of outdoor enthusiasts and social entrepreneurs that are on a mission to redefine waste, a journey from biological research to a Pan-American overland trip. And a Fulbright scholarship in Argentina brought Taylor's passion for environmental advocacy and scientific communication into the nonprofit sector. Similarly, Thor transitioned from studying sociology and anthropology in Australia's bush to capturing expedition media at all ends of the earth, blending his skill set with his ventures around adventures with purpose. In 2018, they co-founded Do Good Shit, a 501c3 nonprofit. I just like having you on here because shit is one of my favorite words and I can say it like legit right now. dedicated to addressing waste management issues in outdoor recreation areas and their surrounding communities. So their upcoming project sites include Mount Hood, Lake Tahoe, Chile, Nepal, Argentina, and more. So Thor and Taylor, come on down. Price is Right. Let's dance it out. Hey, because one of the things that I want to talk about, yes, and the dog. I love it so much. One of the things that I really liked what Liz was talking about Tucson was like every trailhead has a bathroom. This is a huge part of making adventure accessible in an urban environment. So as a transition of like, how do you navigate through the city and not poop on the sidewalk? What are you guys up to as Taylor and Thor? Who are you and where are you currently?
So we are currently in Lake Tahoe, California, where we live. I'm Taylor.
That's Thor.
Thor. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah. it's really interesting to think about urban hiking, Liz, mm-hmm. and the bathroom situation. You know, we work with a lot of trailheads, but it's more the parking lot, trailhead, outdoor more traditional outdoor recreation setting. And so it's super interesting to think more in that civic mm-hmm. recreation setting, which ties a little bit into a spin on our project that we've been looking at. But I imagine that the use of wag bags in urban hiking isn't like super applicable on street corners either. So yeah.
So Liz, did you ever have any situations where like it was just an emergency and you had to like figure it out and you couldn't walk a mile to the bathroom, or are you like knocking on people's doors as you're going through a residential area, or what was the deal?
It hasn't gotten quite that bad. I've definitely been able to like pee discreetly behind bushes. It's not my favorite to do it in an urban setting, although I do it all the time when I'm on a trail. But yeah, knock on wood that continues to be the case.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Liz. If you're able to stick around for the group gratitude circle, we'd love to have you. So I appreciate your time.
Yay! Great to connect.
You're awesome, Liz. Keep it up.
Keep it up.
Thanks.
Taylor and Thor, oh my gosh, you guys rock. How did you meet? What's the situation here? Are you guys together? Are you partners in business? Or like, you also enjoy each other romantically? Like, what's the deal? What's your story?
We like to say that we're partners in business and partners in life.
Yeah.
We originally met through a team that was doing Expedition Media and telling the stories of adventure with purpose with a lot of other nonprofits, and met through that team, started working together, and life takes on its own forms, I guess.
Amazing.
So here we are. Yeah.
So what led you to, I mean, we read the bio, but like, where were you individually and what were you doing? And then how did Do Good Shit come out of that?
Yeah. So this kind of takes us back to November, 2018, as our team was kind of traveling around the world, chasing this idea of capturing adventures with purpose. You know, we got drawn to Mount Everest because it's Mount Everest, and we wanted to have some kind of purposeful element behind that. So we decided to partner with a nonprofit that was doing some human waste management work there. Pretty ambitious goals, but essentially we went there to document the 26,000 pounds of human waste left on that mountain annually.
That's like a lot of poop.
Every year. 26,000 pounds of poop.
Yeah, and so essentially what
just making sure I heard that right.
It's a lot. We're talking tons here. It's essentially what they do every season is they porter all this shit off the mountain into Gorik Shep, which is, you can think of it as the highest town there in on the Everest on the Everest base camp trek. And they just dump it in these big like 13-foot holes. And so what we encountered was seeing this problem firsthand, right? Mm-hmm. And once we could really understand the immensity of this problem, is like, okay, this is more than Mount Everest. This has to be more than Mount Everest.
So at the time I was living in Argentina and I had completed the Pan American Highway overlanding trip. And then had been living down in Bariloche for about 2 years, which is where I originally met our friend Emily. And I remember getting a field message on my sat phone from the team in Everest while I was on a climbing trip in a place called Piedra Parada that said, like, describe the situation and signed off, like, do good shit. And I went climbing that day, and I have this really annoying thing where every time I get to the wall and see like a vertical face, I feel like I have to poop. So like before I put on my harness, I always have to go through that thing. And I think a lot of people, from what I understand, have
it's like before a bird takes off, you know, it's a similar thing.
Yeah. And I like went to dig a cat hole and I was like finding what we refer to as brown trouts and toilet paper lily pads. And it was gross. And I was like, wow, this issue is so not isolated to Everest. And we're big skiers, we're big climbers, mountaineers. And it was all the adventures that we were having all over the world. We continue to see the same issue. And it was kind of like, huh, you know, you go to these really amazing nature settings for this pristine environment. And then you like run into other people's waste. That's gross.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like there wasn't really anyone filling that space. And our whole mission has been to incorporate purpose into our adventures. And so we were like, let's be the poop people. And we founded Do Good Shit as a nonprofit. And it's been a really cool formula to be able to give back to the places that we recreate anyways. And yeah, it's been an exciting journey. I never really thought that I would be like talking about poop and pee in toilets as much as I currently do, but I'm trying to just run with it.
I like it. Oh my gosh. So what was the project down in Bariloche?
So couple that which project?
Is that where your first poop project was?
Yeah. So okay. I had lived there for a couple years, and when we founded the nonprofit, we got connected to this actual poop guru who lives in Seattle. He has a PhD in remote site human waste management, and he really like coached us through a lot of the tech options and like what systems were available, and connected us to some people that were wanting to do this sort of work. And we partnered with the Torres del Paine Legacy Fund, actually in Torres del Paine National Park in Chile. And that's where we did our first project at the end of last year. Mm-hmm. And we are installing 3 toilets in the park there. And some of them are not 100% done at this point. Thank you, COVID. We were supposed to be back down there this fall. But yeah, and now it's actually really cool because Piedra Parada, the place that's closer to Bariloche, where I was when we kind of had the inception of this idea, there is a toilet that my colleagues there are installing actually on November 10th. And so we kind of have some fun homecoming projects going on in the next year. We're also touching back to Everest and the Khumbu Valley. Mm-hmm. So it feels good to go back to those original touch points as well.
And so when you say you're installing toilets, are these pit toilets? Are they better than pit toilets? Like, how are you guys actually managing the waste?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. I'm going to take a step back, and we were able to successfully fund the first toilets down in Torres del Paine about 8-9 months before end of the year. And so at that point we knew of some solutions, but we weren't able to completely legitimize or back up the fact that these things were effective in what they did. And that was, it was a proper human waste management system. Right. And so what Taylor and I did was, well, let's go see if these things work. Right. And so we did a 2.5-month, 3-month road trip in the Pacific Northwest,
a toilet tour.
And that was our take on one, getting our hands dirty, literally, and really trying to understand what does it mean to be more than a pit toilet. Like, why do pit toilets suck? It's because they suck, right? There's got to be a better way. And so we identified a system. It's French technology, and it's essentially a conveyor belt toilet which uses gravity to source separate the liquid down, and then this conveyor belt to then manually put it into a different container.
Yeah. And I think the base of that, not getting, we could go super
into, you go deep, if
we
you
could
want.
Go deep, but we're not going to go it. Right now. but basically there's a lot of different technologies that can accomplish kind of the same general idea, but this is the one we've most frequently worked with. And the whole idea is that you have poop and you have pee. And when you mix the two, mm-hmm. the urea and the urine turns into ammonia, which is that really smelly stuff that you associate with outhouses. And that also kills off the microbes and invertebrates that naturally live in the soil and kind of in our gut and et cetera. And so that compound inhibits a natural decomposition process. And urine, if it's not coming into contact with the bacteria and the icky cooties in solid waste, is actually sterile and self-sanitizing. And it's full of a lot of good nutrients for plants like nitrogen and phosphorus. And so if he's chasing the puppy around the room right now,
yay,
being naughty. but if you just don't let the pee and poop come in contact with each other, then you can let nature process waste in a way that's a lot more in line. It's like biomimicry, right? Like, what does nature naturally do to process waste? And talking about dogs, like when we walk our dog, or if you walk your dog, you're going to notice that it goes pee, it walks 10 more feet or so, and it goes poop. And there's a reason it doesn't perform those two activities in the same exact physical location. And in fact, humans are the only mammals that do mix their liquid and solid waste.
Wow. I did not know that. Learning something new today.
Yeah. And that's like a super weird social construct that we have as a society that's rooted in our desire for privacy. So we hold it. So we do everything at once because it's convenient. So we can flush it and it's out of sight. But nature isn't set up to process waste like that. And so the toilets that we use, you know, don't require a massive behavior change. People can just do their business, but it takes the liquids and it puts them into a drain field where they can just, you know, be sterile and be taken up by plants. And then the solids go back into a decomposition chamber where those microbes and invertebrates just like turn it into a dark humusy soil, and it does its thing.
That is so freaking cool. So you were talking about the conveyor belt. I have a story from our trip last year. So we were in Michigan. We were in New York, parked on a lake, and we went to the bathroom in a porta potty. I've never seen a porta potty do this. but it had the slide for the poop. And so you like crank this thing and it just like conveyor belts it around. And so I don't know if there was a function that separates urine from poop, but there was a poop slide. Like that's what Barry called it. Like he was like, there is a poop slide in this porta potty.
Which super sounds similar.
Sounds
super
similar.
Fun. Yeah. The ones we have like a foot pedal. And we actually went to one in Mount Rainier National Park that had like a little porthole. And we both used it. We were like, did you watch it go as you were pedaling? Cause you could like peer over and like watch your poop, like drop into the void. And like, yeah, I mean, people don't lose their childlike affinity for that kind of thing.
Everyone poops.
Everybody does. And I don't know why we don't talk about it more. That's why we're normalizing poop conversations here.
That's why we're chattering taboos right now. Here we go.
Yeah. I love it. So there's the separation. So is there anything added to the poop part of the chamber, or is it just like, it just naturally does what it does?
It does what it does. And dude, you know, there's a
why
lot
are
of-
we not doing this on a more like, on a, like, why doesn't this have a
global
residential
scale
application? Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things we talk about a lot. It's like, how do we expand this philosophy around source separation into in a different way? And
I think one hurdle there, one big hurdle is this gold standard of this concept of out of sight, out of mind, perpetuated by the convenience of like, you flush your shit and it's gone. You're like, sick, wash my hands. I'm like,
but I
that
think
thing, we
people
have to break
don't
that down.
Think farther than that. You know, like we were talking the other day, we're sitting here and Thor's like, where does our waste go when we flush
like, we
our
have a
toilet?
You know,
like, do you know the answer to that question?
Nope.
Oh, no? Like when you use a porta potty, do you know where that actually goes? No.
Nope.
And so I think if people can take that thought process of one step further, it's actually really insightful. Like it's a pretty broken system when it comes down to it.
Yeah, it really is. And so, cause I'm thinking like when I first started thinking about different ways of managing waste was when we were thinking about how we want to build our wellness center. And like, we don't want to like, we want to build out remote off the grid. We don't necessarily want a septic tank. So we're looking at like incinerating toilets or the composting toilets. So like, why is it really just because we like to flush and not think about it? Like, how, is there, do you guys have a hypothesis in your mind of like what it would take to start to change the attitudes around waste management, like in a civic perspective?
Yeah, we're doing actually a lot of work around that. So one of the things,
current project
for a long time,
sweet. God, it's like I'm psychic or something. This is wild.
Amazing. For a long time, our projects were these really remote sites where you're in the middle of a park and you want to confine your human impact to this tiny little square of space. And, you know, like visitation has gotten too high. If people keep digging cat holes, you're running out of soil space. The impact is too large. So let's put it all in one place and let's keep it there. Moving into some more complex environments for our projects, like the Kumbh Valley in Nepal, you have these communities that are pushed right up against that trail. And this is where like, you know, some of the urban hiking conversation is interesting when you have those mountain communities kind of that line kind of blurs, you know?
Yeah.
And so those communities have, and especially in Nepal, are already harnessing some of their human waste and repurposing it. And so the stakeholders in our projects have been asking, you know, okay, well, how do we take this a step farther? And we've gotten connected to all these people doing amazing research in the industry and studying more about regenerative models and agriculture and all these things. And I think that one of the big, you know, challenges is redefining waste. And the whole thing of, I mean, this stretches from solid, from like human waste to organic waste to plastic waste, you know, like when you throw something away or when you flush something away, there's no such place as away. And so we need to stop viewing waste as waste. And when it comes to the waste that is in our body, urine is a really valuable resource. It's a really valuable fertilizer. It's chock full of good nutrients for plants. It can be used in agricultural practices. And the same goes for solid waste and compost. Like that's valuable food product that came from the soil and can go back into the soil. And so I think that getting people to see a circular system, you know, like in general in our society, sustaining isn't enough. Sustaining what we're doing right now and sustainability is not enough. How do we regenerate that model?
Yeah.
And so we're looking at our projects and how to turn it into a circular system where we're able to actually harness and collect the urine and the solids and then repurpose it into, you know, farms and community gardens and agricultural practices. And there's a lot of institutes doing all of these small scale projects all over the place. And how do we elevate that conversation and bring those people together? And it's a big far reaching goal.
That's pretty ambitious.
But we're in, you know, it's
cool. Well, and the thing is like, cause I recently watched Kiss the Dirt on Netflix talking about like soil regeneration. And I'm like, I'm learning about this. I'm learning about like waste management. I'm like, these two, they're beautiful and they work together. Like we could literally solve all the problems if we could just not flush our shit. Right. Like in my mind, like it seems like it's that simple and I know it's not easy, but the conversations around sustainability and to your point, regeneration, like these are simple concepts. Like they're very easy to understand, but they're hard to implement, I guess.
They are. And the other thing is you have so much existing infrastructure. So you have sunk cost of water treatment facilities and, you know, septic facilities. And so, you know, there's all the money that's under the ground already, especially here in the United States. That's why sometimes getting ahead of the curve and in developing places is easier because that infrastructure doesn't even exist yet.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And in that case, it's like, who's really the third world country, right? Like the one that doesn't have anything but can build regenerative practices from the get-go, or us where everything just like sucks.
Totally.
And to like put more context behind that, there's recently been a huge push around what's called container-based sanitation, which is essentially capturing liquid and solid waste in separate vestibules. And there's been an alliance that's been formed with 8+ organizations that are on the ground in Haiti, Madagascar, Uganda. Like there's places that don't have the resources they can to build a multi-million dollar infrastructure. However, they're successfully implementing an ecological sanitation model where they're already have this model in place. And so we're over here scratching our head like we got, let's figure this out, create some kind of mobile aspect so we're not, you know, completely upending the infrastructure and start educating around that through this new kind of lens.
Yeah. And that's the other thing is like in every context, it's that awareness piece. And in the outdoor industry, you know, Liz, I hope that there's a section in your book that in Through Hiking that talks about how to manage your waste on the trail, because it's something that people so often overlook. And we have all of these trainings around first aid and what to have in your first aid kit and your preparedness for emergencies and whatever, but do you have your waste kit in right up there on the same level as your first aid kit? Do you have your little shovel and your bag and your TP? And do you know safe practices? And how can we educate people on that? How can we raise that to the same level of importance without people getting all sheepish or just forgetting to even think about it because they're not used to thinking about it? And in Tahoe this summer, we're talking about this before we went live, we saw such this huge influx of tourism here and new outdoor users and recreationalists. And we're stoked to see that. Let's share this beautiful space. But there's education that needs to happen because if you've never had to poop outside before, I don't blame you for not knowing what to do. It's not super intuitive. So like, let's talk about it. Let's educate around it.
Yeah. And on the Tahoe note, I know that's on your list of upcoming projects. So I'd love to hear about what you guys are working on. And I hope that it fills in the blank here. The pit toilets at Eagle Rock are disgusting. Like they are nasty up like on top of like Emerald Bay and the falls and stuff. Every time we've gone there, well, one, it's there's two stalls for a really popular trailhead, so it's like there's trash everywhere, but like the smell is atrocious and it's like it might as well be like overflowing. It smells like it's about to. So what kind of work can be done, thinking of Tahoe in particular, like what could be done to improve existing facilities, and then what are you guys looking to do in Tahoe?
So one of the things I think you asked at one point as well, like what's so bad about a pit toilet? Many of those systems are actually considered large capacity cesspools, depending on the volume of and the depth of the pit, because some of them are so deep and so big that they're actually touching groundwater and then contaminating everything. And Tahoe has really, really strict, luckily, practices for the watershed, and so it's hard for us to even permit our toilets, which that gets into a whole deal around county and regulations and the bureaucracy you meet when you try to do below the ground infrastructure of any kind, but but improving existing systems, like you can retrofit those buildings to have source separating units on them really easily, which is a recommendation.
I mean, that's just piping the urine out of the facility. And now you're reuse, like you'd have to clear out the pit toilet mm-hmm. which would definitely be a little bit of a lift. Mm-hmm. But once it's clear and you're only putting in solid waste and having that other liquid waste go into either a leach field or some other container, mm-hmm. that would be the next step for already implemented mm-hmm. infrastructure. But like a step that we're trying to take is semi-permanent, you know, tourist season infrastructure where you could think advanced porta potty on Donner Summit snow shed wall, mm-hmm. where you got people driving old 40, spending the whole day out there climbing mm-hmm. and one and two happen. And so having like one or two units in these very specified locations that mm-hmm. don't require permitting, but you are able to address the problem and do it for a seasonal demand. Mm-hmm. So that'd be like that's one step smart. That we're gearing up to do.
Yeah. And then just promotion of educational materials is always a big challenge and something that we're focused on. It's, you know, when we go out and recreate in wilderness areas, we don't always want to see infrastructure either. You know, you're walking on a trail, you don't want to see some building all the time. Yeah. And right. so we get that sentiment of not wanting that. And we try to identify and quantify kind of where the visitation volume and the human impact reaches kind of the critical point where there's a conflict and you need yeah. infrastructure to support it. And so, you know, kind of below that line, teaching people to how to properly dig cat holes, how to get away from water sources, to have a bag prepped to pack out their teepee, not to light it on fire, like all of those things. And then when you hit that critical point,
you'd be surprised. like Torres del Paine, the first place we worked, like what, 30% of it burned down from someone lighting their teepee on fire. Like mm-hmm. huge 30% fire.
Of the park
for teepee.
From teepee.
Like 2-ply, 3 yeah. sheets.
Yeah.
Boom.
My yeah.
God, that's wild. Like my first backpacking trip was on the Trans-Catalina Trail. There's bathrooms at every campground. So like you just put your toilet where it goes. Or your toilet paper where it goes. And then we did the Grand Canyon of the Tuolumne in Yosemite High Country this summer. Okay. And that was the first one where it was like, okay, bury your poop, carry out your teepee. And I was like, this isn't that bad. Like, why does everybody freak out about it? Like yeah. you put your teepee in your food bag, it's sealed up. And then you don't like your old like pouch, not yeah. like the food that you eat, the used food bag. And then yeah. it's like, it doesn't smell. It's not a big deal. Like what's the problem? I don't understand why this is so hard, but I do because I didn't know how to poop outside for a while. So.
Right. And you get in situations like we kind of have a running joke. Also, this is a good call out, but, we have a running joke, like if you're not pooping your pants, you're not living hard enough, sort of. Like if you don't
dude, I've got stories.
If you don't have good poop stories, you're probably not living your life hard enough. Yeah. But we want to write a book highlighting people's poop stories. And so
I got one for you. I'm ready.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to hear it.
Right down.
If you're watching this and you have a good poop story, reach out to us at Do Good Shit because we want to highlight you. We
want to help break down that taboo. Like we gotta normalize the conversation yeah. that mm-hmm. poop is just nutrients that we haven't repurposed yet. Like that's what it comes mm-hmm. down to.
Also, yeah. tell us your poop story. Can you?
For sure. Of course. Yeah. It was in the book. So I was on the Trans-Catalina Trail the first time. This is a 38.5 mile trail that goes across Catalina Island. Mm-hmm. I was day two. This is my first backpacking trip. One, I had no idea what I was doing. Two, I was in a tremendous amount of pain. The first day you're going up and down 5 peaks. The next day is all downhill all day. And I was like, oh yeah, downhill all day. I'm in. No, downhill all day is terrible. I didn't know that, but it sounded nice. So we had just left the airport in the sky. So like you go to Blackjack Campground, like 2 miles later, you're at the airport. So like bathroom break, food break, they sell all kinds of delicious treats there. So I got a bison burger. I was like five left. Exactly. Yeah. So we left the airport. I was far enough where I couldn't turn and run to go back. I was also in this area where there's roads up here where they do the eco tours. So it's like tourists watching hikers like me. This is Southern California island hiking. So it's like sagebrush, chaparral, sage plants. Like there's nothing to squat behind or coverage. So I'm like, oh my God. Oh my, like, this is an emergency. What do I do? So before this trip, when I went shopping for my hiking clothes, cause this is my first backpacking trip, I was in the dressing room and I was like a sausage getting into these pants. Cause at the time I was 70 pounds heavier than I am today. And REI didn't sell anything bigger than a 16. So I was like, oh my God. And so the pants had snaps and not buttons. So in my mind, I have this like montage, this movie montage when I was trying on these pants that if it had buttons, then I would probably blow a button. And then like it would hit Barry in the eye. We'd be down one eye in the backcountry. He's half blind. We're messed. Like it's over. This is just in the dressing room. This is when this is happening. So my other alternative was like, okay, well these pants have snaps. And so now I'm thinking like, oh my God, like these pants are so tight. They're just going to tear off like tearaway pants. And so I was just like, hi, Lydia. This is Barry's mom. Hi.
Hi, Lydia.
How you doing? So we did, I was worried about that just threw me off. So I was worried about the tearaway pants, but then, so like now I'm about to like put my pants on the trail and I can't go to the bathroom. There's nothing to squat behind. There's no way I'm digging a hole. Like this is peeing out your butt poop. And so I was like, the title of the chapter of the book is called Thankful for Snaps, because I was really thankful that I didn't have to fumble with buttons, because I just like ripped them open, tore them down, and was like, I'm so sorry, wildlife. Like there was nothing I could do about it. And it's on a slope. So now I'm like squatting, trying to like avoid the poop that's like going down the hill. It was a whole thing.
That is the whole thing. Well, you're definitely going to be in the book. And you've already written it.
That might be a feature. Yeah. Oh my God.
And then if there's a visual component of it, I'll tell the story standing up and I'll be like, and this is what it was like when I was trying to avoid the poop. Like,
yeah,
it was wild. So yeah. Do you have poop stories? Anybody else? Hey, if you've got questions for Taylor and Thor, pop on your camera. If you got a poop story to share, pop on your camera. Liz, I got to know, like you already made it sound like you've got it under control, but I feel like you've done a lot of hiking. You've got to have
a
poop story.
No way.
There's no way. She's done all the trails ever. So like, yeah. What? Hi, Mary. What you got?
Well, my first through hike or long hike was also on the Catalina Trail a few weeks ago, inspired by Sydney. And nice. The whole first day I kept thinking about like, when's it going to happen? I know I'm going to have to poop. Like I was either going to barf or shit my pants like the first day. And for me, it came day two. Almost, I couldn't make it to the airport. I was like almost to the airport. And I kept being like, oh God, I think I got to stop. And then like, no, I can do it. I can do it. And finally I was like, it's now or never. And there was like the only tree in like for miles.
That's the only tree. Like, I know exactly where you stopped.
Yes. I like walk around. It's like, I can see the airport right up above, but there was no way I was going to make it. Like I walk around the tree and I was so pissed because there was toilet paper and someone else's poop just like sitting there.
There it is.
So that just like ruined it for me, but I did it. I cleaned it up. I brought it with me to the airport. I was like so proud of myself. Not a big deal. And I was like so proud of myself.
I left poop on the mountain, but like I covered it up. I just want to like cover my tracks here. But I did pack out my toilet paper or my napkin. I didn't even have toilet paper. I had napkins from the airport that Barry had bought. Thank God. So he could blow his nose. I was like, we're having an emergency. I had to do that twice, by the way. The first time was a scary time, but yeah.
And I just have to say, I love your quote. I wrote it down. If you're not pooping your pants, you're not living hard enough. I can't wait to share that with my family. Like my brothers and sisters and I, we are constantly sharing pooping your pants stories, and it's our favorite thing to do. So
I love it.
I'm glad we're not the only ones.
Do good shit too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't wait to tell them about you guys. So thank good. You for doing love good it. Shit.
Thank you, Mary.
Thanks, Mary.
Liz.
So Liz, tell us something, up. Girl. Like if you say that you've never pooped your pants or been close, I'm just going to be like, I don't even believe you anymore.
Bullshit.
Yeah, there's actually a saying among thru hikers, like there's two types of thru hikers, those who pooped their pants and those who are lying.
Yep. I believe it.
So are you lying or have you pooped your pants?
Yeah, I have. Although the close call stories are, oh man, you know, like as Mary was telling her story, I was like, oh, what about that one? What about that one? I think, you know, I have too many. And really, you know, when I get together with friends, inevitably at some point of the night, this is what we end up talking about, which I'm sure is true for Taylor as well. One of my stories is I was on the GDT, which is the, goes along the Canadian Rockies. And I was hiking with a new partner. We were doing this 800-mile route that like people hadn't really done that much before. And everything was like kind of these like shoddy paper maps. And I had them in the pockets of my skirt, and I went to go poop. I dug my hole, I went to go poop, packed out my toilet paper, and I felt around in my pockets and realized that my maps had fallen into my pile of poop. There was no way. Like, these were the only maps that we had. The GPS data wasn't that great. I was like, oh no, what do we do? I put the maps in with my toilet paper in my trash bag because there was no way I was going to keep using that. But I was like, you do have an extra set of maps, right? Like, you're carrying your own set of maps, right? And luckily, like, we were able to navigate off of her maps for the rest of the trip. But it was definitely like a really interesting way to get to know someone, being like, all right, I don't know you that well, but I'm going to have to use your maps because mine have poop on them.
Oh my gosh. That's a really good story. I love that so much. We're definitely going to have you when we're putting together the book as well. You're both in the book.
So YouTube is on a little bit of a delay, and my husband Barry is sitting in the room watching it. And so, like, we're all talking, and Liz has already talked about the pile of poop, and I just hear him go, Barry, go. I was like, oh, he just heard about the maps and the pile of poop. Okay, cool. Yeah, carry on.
Oh my God.
That's so awesome. Oh, yeah, I love it. When I drove the Pan American Highway, that's another setting, adventure setting, where like pooping is a big conversation. And we used to say that we could gauge how good a friendship was going to end up being based on how quickly the poop conversation came up.
Oh yeah. Like, if you're not down to talk about it, like, cause we went our Yosemite trip. We went with our friend K-Bong and we had done some adventures, like we had done the Eagle Lake, Dix Lake, Velma's Loop.
That's so pretty.
So pretty.
I did that with my mom.
Yeah. And it was just like, it was a real quick day hike. Like there wasn't any like off trail pooping that had to be done. But then we went out for like a 54-mile adventure and I was like, okay, are we going to do it? And the first day he's like, so let's talk about pooping. Like, and then we were just like, this is going to be a great adventure. It's so true. Because like, if you're not down to talk about poop, I don't think we're down to be adventure buddies. Like,
yeah, that means you're probably surface pooping and nobody likes
that. Nobody likes a surface pooper, guys. Oh my gosh. Okay, so does anybody have questions for Taylor and Thor and or Liz? Because we got everybody on camera right now. If you do, pop on your cameras. If you don't, pop on your cameras anyway, because we can jump into a group gratitude circle and close this sucker down.
Thank you for joining us around the virtual campfire. Sometimes we talk about heavy topics, sometimes we tell poop stories, but regardless of what we've discussed, we always like to end the show on a high note. At the end of our live broadcasts, we invite our community to share what they're grateful for in a segment called the Group Gratitude Circle. Every week, I'm thankful for you. Thank you for taking time out of your busy life to connect with us and witness these stories of hope, healing, and inspiration in the outdoors. If you'd like to gather with us around the campfire live each week, join the Hiking My Feelings virtual campfire VIPs. If this were a legit talk show, you'd be sitting in our studio audience. We haven't been picked up by a major network yet, so for now, we gather on Zoom. Here, you can connect with the community before and after the broadcast, hang out for soundcheck when we have musical guests, participate in the Q&A, join in on the group gratitude circle, and be eligible to receive prizes and gifts from our sponsors, partners, and guests. Learn more and join us at hikingmyfeelings.org/campfire. Don't forget to leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with your friends, family, colleagues, and anyone else who could use a dose of community and connection. Follow us on Instagram. We're at hikingmyfeelings, and you can tag your journey with #hikingmyfeelings. And if you're picking up what we're putting down and you want to be part of this movement, join the Hiking My Feelings family at family.hikingmyfeelings.org. In case nobody told you lately, you are a brilliant human who is destined to do epic things in this world. Join us next week for more stories of hope, healing, and inspiration in the outdoors. Until then, happy trails!